Hi, this is Arnie Arneson, and this is the Friday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. We Zoom on Thursday. I want a reminder, just in case something should happen Thursday night, we'll have to discuss it on Monday. We begin our show, as you've come to expect, with the powerful testimony of Lieutenant Colonel Vindman during the impeachment hearings of 2019. We started this months ago, and at the time we started, he hadn't been walked out of the White House yet. At the time that we started, he hadn't been reassigned yet. At the time that we started, he hadn't decided to retire yet. Every time I hear him, I'm reminded, this is the strength of America. It's a place where people come from all over the world. He's an immigrant. After the story of Kamala Harris's family, they are immigrants. He is also a patriot. He's also someone so wise and smart. And I wanted you to have his words during this impeachment hearing ringing in your ears when you exercise the franchise in November of 2020 in any way, shape, or form you choose to exercise it. Now, Lieutenant Colonel Vindman.
Next month will mark 40 years since my family arrived in the United States as refugees. When my father was 47 years old, he left behind his entire life and the only home he had ever known to start over in the United States so his three sons could have a better and safer lives. His courageous decision inspired a deep sense of gratitude in my brothers and myself and instilled in us a sense of duty and service. All three of us have served or are currently serving in the military. My little brother sits behind me here today. Our collective military service is a special part of our family's history, a story in America. I'm grateful for my father's brave act of hope 40 years ago and for the privilege of being an American citizen and public servant, where I can live free and free of fear for mine and my family's safety. Dad, I'm sitting here today in the U.S. Capitol talking to our elected professionals is proof that you made the right decision 40 years ago to leave the Soviet Union and come here to the United States of America in search of a better life for our family. Do not worry. I will be fine for telling the truth. Thank you again for your consideration. I'll be happy to answer your questions.
So this is going to be a different Friday show. Normally we have Scott Braddock or we have my good friend Stefan Schmidt from Iowa State, but for a lot of reasons, we've sort of changed around the schedule, maybe in part because we have a vice presidential pick. Joe Biden feels more and more like he's not only the candidate who's moving forward in this race, but he may, in fact, be our next elected president of the United States. And that means there are a lot of things we need to talk about. So whenever I think foreign policy, I immediately go to what? I go to Mel Goodman. The reason I go to Mel Goodman is that his bio alone should tell you why I seek him out. A senior fellow at the Center for International Policy, a professor of government at Johns Hopkins University, a former CIA analyst, he is the author of Failure of Intelligence, The Decline and Fall of the CIA, National Insecurity, The Cost of American Militarism, A Whistleblower at the CIA. His most recent book is American Carnage, The Wars of Donald Trump. I could go on and on and on. There's a new book. He's the author of the forthcoming, has it come out yet? The Dangerous National Security State. It doesn't matter, Mel, because if I ask you when it's coming out, there'll be another book coming out by December.
Going to the publisher next week.
All right, fantastic. I reached out to you because I saw your piece of Counterpunch, which was important, but because we now know that really we're sort of solidifying what's happening with Joe Biden, I went to Foreign Policy Magazine, and they talked about the challenges that Joe Biden will face in order to sort of reestablish our role, what we believe, and how we sort of function on the national stage and the international stage especially. And as it was talking about what does he have to do to sort of regroup and reestablish ourselves, I don't know if I want to go back. I want to reestablish ourselves and I would like to see us going forward and maybe in a very different or at least a somewhat different direction. And as I was getting ready to call you, Mel, the foreign policy article that I found though was fascinating. Listen to this. Inside the massive foreign policy team advising Biden's campaign, if Joe Biden wins, here are some of the top foreign policy experts who could be tapped for senior and mid-level jobs in the administration. But the number that jumped out at me is just remarkable given what we see with this administration compared to Joe Biden. Former U.S. Vice President Joe Biden's team of informal foreign policy and national security advisors has expanded to, sitting down everyone, over 2,000 people, including 20 working groups spanning issues from diversity and national security to arms control, defense, intelligence, homeland security. I saw that number. Not only is the number a huge number, But it also sort of is such an interesting mirror when you look at Donald Trump, because Donald Trump basically has eviscerated our foreign policy. He basically has sort of drained any kind of understanding of who we are and what we believe, because as you point out, he doesn't know anything. But I am kind of looking at this and saying, all right, Mel Goodman, what does 2,000 people mean to you? And what do you suspect Joe Biden will be doing in his first 100 days? It's a challenge, but I'm kind of curious how you read
Let me tell you what I do.
Okay.
First thing, 2,000 people is too many, but I'm not going to quibble with that. Here's what he should do on his first day. Trump on his first day went to the CIA building and made a fool of himself. Biden on his first day should go to the State Department. He should stand in the lobby of the State Department. He should be surrounded by key foreign policy experts from the State Department, regional specialists from the State Department. He would get a standing ovation from the State Department. And in that presentation, he should say, "We are back. The United States is back." He could become a rock star. I don't know how he could space this out. He should go to Mexico. He should go to Canada. He should go to our neighbors and say, "We're back. We're going to stop the diplomacy by insult." Then I think he should go to Europe. He should go to NATO headquarters. And he should tell the leaders of Europe that the transatlantic alliance is back. It's real. He would get an amazing response if he did that in Europe. Then he should get back into the Paris Climate Accord. He should denounce and by executive order reverse all of the terrible things that Trump did to the environmental legacy of Barack Obama. And remember, this is the most evil thing that Trump has done as president, as far as I'm concerned, along with the separation of families at the border, which Biden will say will come to a complete halt. But to reverse these environmental regulations at the time of a pandemic, when you have an infection that's a respiratory disease and attacking the lungs, this is what Trump did by reversing clean air, clean water, clean power. So he would announce that. Then he would make it clear that the Iran nuclear accord, we're back in. This would be welcomed in Russia, it'd be welcomed in China, it would be welcomed in Europe. He would announce when he's in Mexico, I'm stopping the wall. No more appropriations for the wall. And then he would throw out an olive branch carefully to Putin, because we have to get that dialogue back. We have to get back to arms control. So he would announce, I'm coming back into the Intermediate Nuclear Forces Treaty. I'm going to extend, even though we'll have to negotiate, but I'm going to extend the New START Treaty, the treaty that was signed by Obama that reduced launchers to 700 and warheads to 1,500. I'm even going to talk about getting back into the ABM Treaty, which George W. Bush abrogated in 2002. And remember, John Bolton was the senior arms control expert in 2002 when Bush did that.
And saw that in your article. Yep.
Security advisor when Trump pulled out of the INF treaty. And then I would, at that point, say, I'm coming back in, and this would be an olive branch to China in a way, I'm going back into the World Health Organization. It's a pandemic.
Yes.
You need international cooperation. This is essential. Not that we don't have problems with China, particularly human rights problems. What's happening in Xinjiang is very important. What's happening in Hong Kong is important. But we have to deal with China.
Okay, so I'm going to say, I want you to write this article. I want you to write this article. The fact that you start at the State Department and you say we're back, please understand, audience, the State Department really is our soft power. The Pentagon is the hard power, but the State Department is the place where we really sort of create those relationships. It's really where we sort of know how to make our investments. We show the side of us that actually cultivates the kind of support and ultimate security that we need. And the fact that he would go back to the State Department is just so important, because when you look at the impeachment hearings, who are the people that were testifying? Think about that. You know, it was not only our ambassador.
Also about the whistleblower from the CIA who enabled them to testify. You know, without that CIA whistleblower,
yes,
and with the good colonel, as you say, we wouldn't have those State Department people. I don't think they would have come up on their own.
So let's remind everyone, you don't really have to negotiate with your friends. You kind of already have the conversation. You're sort of tweaking it. Who you have to have a conversation with and negotiate with are usually people you don't agree with. And that means Russia and China. So the fact that you're having a conversation with Russia and China is not about an embrace. It's not about a wet kiss. It's about respect. It's about negotiation. It's not about being a puppet like Donald Trump. And I think the fact that you said we have to go back to Russia is so important, but I want people to understand that doesn't mean you do what Donald Trump does. It does mean that you need to understand that Russia is there. It is a power, not necessarily an economic power, but it is unfortunately a foreign power. And it is doing a lot to sort of dismantle what we see happening in Eastern Europe. And I just think that this is really important that you mention Russia and China, because I think that's going to have to be part of what he has to do and remind the American people why he needs to go there.
Yeah. And what I don't think has ever been properly explained to the American people, and I don't think it's properly understood, is the importance of arms control to the Soviet-American dialogue in the first place. If
yes,
there was a successful détente, and even Ronald Reagan was part of that, it was centered around arms control, not economic relations or political relations or social or cultural or ideological relations. It was the SALT Treaty. It was the ABM Treaty. It was the INF Treaty. It was the Conventional Forces in Europe Treaty. This had a lot to do with ending the Cold War, even before the Soviet Union itself dissolved in 1991. And what concerns me now, and this is all of the unfortunate aspects of Trump's lack of diplomacy or lack of understanding of international accord, look at Russia and China. They have the closest state-to-state relationship they have ever had since the 1950s, and it's been centered around opposition to Donald Trump. And I don't think that's properly understood. So we need to break that up. This is what Nixon and Kissinger did very effectively with the Strategic Triangle in 1972, which we leverage for our own interest. So he has taken us out of the multilateral arrangements that are needed in international relations. Biden will put us back in. And as you say about the experts, I think 2,000 is obviously too many. But Biden, his strong suit is he's always surrounded himself with solid people. That was his reputation on the Hill as a senator, as chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. If you look at the people he had around him in the White House as vice president, people like Rod Klain, people like Jake Sullivan, people like Jared Bernstein, the economic specialist, these are solid people. And by the way, I've seen notes when Kamala Harris gave an off-the-record interview with the Council on Foreign Relations during the campaign when they were talking to all the candidates. And even though she doesn't have a strong background that you can look at in terms of a resume, her answers on foreign policy questions were very solid. So he didn't pick her for foreign policy reasons. He's got that skill set. He picked her for other demographic reasons.
Yesterday, when he was talking about his VP pick, Kamala, the one thing that I want people to remember, you just reinforced for me what I think is so important about Joe Biden. And that is, he was not my choice. He was probably one of my last choices. But there is a statement that now is consistent with what you just said. And he said, I want Kamala to be the last person in the room, and I want her to challenge me. I want her to tell me when she thinks I am wrong. And why I say that is that what you just said about the strong people around him is that he brings people in that aren't yes men and women. He brings people in because they have a level of expertise that he needs, that he values, that he needs to assess as he comes to a conclusion. That doesn't mean he rubber stamps them, but the fact is that he's willing to take and listen to that because in a way he wants to make sure that he makes an informed choice. And what you just said, Mel, about his history and this foreign policy and this team that he is historically in and what you saw at the notes from Kamala Harris, this makes me feel so much better because I think this is really important for the American people to understand. Donald Trump can't be even explained to. He doesn't want to hear it. He doesn't want to be confused in his ignorance.
He doesn't know what he doesn't know.
Exactly.
Biden knows what he doesn't know.
Yes.
And what we don't know about Biden and the relationship with Obama, he gave Obama very good advice on foreign policy. Now, all of it wasn't taken. He told Obama, for example, in 2011, don't listen to Hillary Clinton and Susan Rice and Samantha Powers. Don't go into Libya.
Yeah.
Obama, for various reasons, ignored him on that. He said, you've got to get out of Afghanistan. You know, Obama said during the campaign originally that there was a good war and a bad war. Iraq was the bad war. Afghanistan was the good war. No, Afghanistan was not the good war.
It was not.
Years later, we're still there. And Biden tried to tell him that. And he told Obama, be careful in negotiating with the military, which is something Obama didn't do very well. Keeping Gates on as Secretary of Defense, which Biden didn't approve of. Biden didn't vote for Gates for CIA director in 1991, something that Gates has never forgiven him for, which is why he was so harsh on Biden in his memoir that he wrote, the one called Duty. So Biden has been there and gave good advice. He was that last person in the room. And I think when he said that to Kamala Harris, I think he meant it. I think that was genuine.
It's like very Abraham Lincoln-ish.
There's a very essential decency about Joe Biden. You know, he wasn't my first choice either. And I think it's ironic that our leaders are still in their 70s when you look at the House and the Senate. Kamala Harris is the beginning of a generational shift. Someone who's 55, when you think everyone else is in their 70s. Nancy Pelosi, I think maybe 80.
Well, so the one thing that I'm hearing, though, from you is that there is that then sense of wisdom with Joe Biden when it comes to foreign policy. Because foreign policy is something that you can't just step into. You need to have some historical references. You need to understand the history to understand the present, to know where you may be going in the future. Things may be changing because of climate change. Things may be changing because of the pandemic. Things may be changing because of economics. But you really still need to have a sense of that historical reference as you begin to look at the players and what's going on. I mean, what you're telling me about what he did and recommending to Barack Obama ultimately made the decision, but Joe Biden was there to challenge that decision. Now, Mel, you've given me the first 100 days. You've given me the idea that the first place he goes is the State Department. I love you. I think that's a brilliant idea. Now my question is, if you could pick his people, who would you pick for Secretary of Defense? Who would you pick to be on his national security team? I'm kind of curious, you know who he knows, and it may not be the Mel Goodman pick, but if you were sort of putting yourself in the head of Joe Biden, give me a sort of a sense of reference of what this team would look like or could look like in order for him to deliver what you just suggested in the first 100 days that would also be able to sort of start literally day one.
Well, he has to go back into the direction of globalization and realistic international policy.
Right.
And I would go for Secretary of State William Burns, who was the Deputy Secretary of State, who's now the head of the Carnegie Endowment, would be my Secretary of State.
Okay.
Jake Sullivan, who was his foreign policy advisor and was very important to John Kerry for negotiating the Iran nuclear accord, would run the National Security Council. I have a feeling, though, that Susan Rice is going to be given that position. I don't think she'll be turned to for Secretary of State because she'll run into all sorts of confirmation problems as she did before. Whether it was fair or not, she was really beat up over Benghazi, which she didn't handle very well. That was a ball that Hillary Clinton threw to her because Hillary Clinton knew that ball was loaded and she didn't want to have to deal with it. But Susan Rice, to me, doesn't have the personality to be a Biden person. I thought all the rumors about her were far-fetched. She was never going to be in the vice presidential selection. And she would have come across as a wonk and not a real political type. Kamala Harris is a great political personality.
Yes, you're
The CIA, I would get Gina Haspel out of there as soon as possible because of her linkage to torture and abuse. And remember that Trump brought John Yoo back into the White House 2 weeks ago, and he was the one who wrote all of the torture and abuse memos that opened the door
justified
to abuse for the CIA. So for CIA, I think they should have a State Department veteran. Maybe Thomas Pickering is too old, but someone of that stature who understands policy and understands the role of intelligence in supporting policy, not making policy, but supporting policy in terms of pointing global problems and global opportunities for policy making.
So who would you appoint to the UN?
Wow.
It plays on an interesting stage. It's sort of a very media appointment as more maybe than a substantive appointment. But it also sort of says a little bit about who he is and where he wants to play.
It tells you a lot about what the United States wants to be in the international community. It has to be a Bill Richardson type person. Again, too many years on Bill Richardson, but I'm sure there are a lot of people like that. No name comes to mind immediately, but someone who's known to the international community, who is close to the White House and has the ear of the president and speaks for the United States coming back into the international arena, coming back into the World Health Organization, taking its seat at the table at the World Trade Organization. Now, I don't think when I saw her notes, Kamala Harris's notes, the Council on Foreign Relations, she has the same negative position about the Trans-Pacific Partnership that Trump has, and Hillary Clinton had, actually, and Bernie Sanders had. But I think we should be back in the TPP. I think it's unfortunate that we stayed away from the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which allowed Japan to take the lead. The 12 nations have stuck together. If we're going to compete with China in the Pacific, that's the way you do it as part of the TPP. If it needs improvement, if it needs some surgical improvement, then you engage in that. But
Someone wrote an article at New Republic a couple of months ago and suggested that rather than reentering the TPP, that we should create the sort of the variation on a theme with the EU. in a lot of ways, assume that this is where we could sort of develop our strength. That was a suggestion that I thought was fascinating. I don't know whether it will go anywhere, but because the pandemic has sort of changed our conversation about trade in, you know, at the very basic level. But let me talk, I want to talk about the World Health
Organization. Let me respond to that, because that's something I've thought about.
Okay.
One of the mistakes that China is making, if you read the Asian press, they're talking about the warrior diplomats of Xi Jinping in China. We have an opportunity to form an EU-type organization that would put pressure on China. China would not necessarily be a part of it, but we would go to the Southeast Asian countries who fear China. Japan would play a leading role, but Thailand, the Philippines, Malaysia, Singapore, all of these important countries with very important economies. Remember, we're entering the Asian century. If you look at the economic growth of these Southeast Asian countries and add to it Taiwan and Japan and South Korea, there's a huge shift in economic markets and economic trade and economic investment. And we need to compete with China on that level because their Asian infrastructure and investment bank has been very successful. Obama was wrong to fight it. We should have encouraged it. We want them to be a stakeholder in these things. But you have to recognize the fact that China is a power. And I don't know if we're able to do that. We shouldn't look at China as a threat to try. We can't contain China. China isn't the Soviet Union. The Cold War that was fought with the Soviet Union was a very easy war because the Soviet Union was really just Upper Volta with nuclear weapons, as a lot of people used to say. China is the real thing.
Well, China is a huge economy that makes everything. We now know it because we couldn't get face masks. We now know it because, I mean,
we're the world's factory. We're the world's customer.
Exactly.
And our debt is...
It's owned by them. China. It's owned by them.
They own us. We've got to compete. We've got to acknowledge that.
So, Mel, you're going to think I'm a crazy lady, but I wanted at the Democratic Convention to spend an hour and do an hour on math, do an hour on economic math, the math that defines us, the math that explains us, the idea of China holding our debt, the idea of the cost of a drug, the idea of what the cost of unemployment, and someone just spend an hour and say, we're going to do the math that explains our policies, that explains our economics, that explains our healthcare, and they could do it in a very fun way. But in the end, nobody knows this stuff, Mel. And it really is about the numbers.
There's another area that no one knows.
Exactly right.
Spend an hour on arms control and disarmament and start with the mistake that Bill Clinton made when he abolished the Arms Control and Disarmament Agency in 1996 because Jesse Helms was putting some pressure on him. Oh, and Bill Clinton caved in to Jesse Helms. So tell people the importance of reducing nuclear weapons and tell people we don't need to be putting $1.2 trillion, which right now we're going to be doing, into modernizing nuclear weapons that have no utilitarian value whatsoever.
Exactly. And so again, that's do the math. And if people saw the numbers and we connected the dots, I would love someone to do that. But I don't think that's obviously not going to happen. Let me just go back to the EU idea, though. You know, one of the reasons why I would love to somehow create this relationship and this trade relationship, this economic relationship with the EU, it will make us better. Because the EU has higher standards than us on everything, on how they deal with trust and monopoly issues, on how they deal with the environment, on how they deal with worker issues. So not only would it create this powerhouse, as you point out, that could go back into Southeast Asia and be the counterweight to China, but it would make us a healthier, more sustainable economy, and we will all be effectively stronger as a result.
Oh, I thoroughly agree. And you have to remember that in the European Union and the European Alliance and all of the various European market arrangements, that's a very sophisticated series of political alliances.
Yes.
Asia actually, for all of its economic success, is politically backward. They don't have that kind of organizational strength.
Exactly.
I think the United States could lead the way, and it would show China that, no, we're not trying to contain you, but we are trying to compete with you.
Yes.
And we can be very successful in this competition. And our economics would prosper.
I love you, Melvin Goodman. See, this is why I have you on, because I need to dream. I need to know about the first 100 days. I need to know the names of these people that he might want to do. You got to write these articles. I'm just telling you right now, because can't end here.
It's all low-hanging fruit for Joe Biden. Frankly, I think this is going to be his problem is going to be domestic.
Yes, I know that. Mel Goodman is a senior fellow at the Center for International Policy and a professor of government at Johns Hopkins University, a former CIA analyst. He is the author of so many books, I can't go through them all. Mel Goodman, thank you so much for joining us. You're making me smile.
Always great to be with you.
Okay, ciao. Bye-bye.
Bye now.
All right, everyone, stick around. A little John Nichols from The Nation magazine is next.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. this day in labor history, the year was 1936. That was the day that President Franklin Delano Roosevelt signed the Social Security Act into law. The act was a key piece of the president's New Deal, a series of federal programs responding to the ravages of the Great Depression. Social Security would provide an income for retirees and the disabled to ensure that they did not slide into complete destitution. On signing the bill, President Roosevelt, known for delivering memorable speeches, addressed the press. He said, quote, "Today, the hope of many years standing in large part fulfilled. The civilization of the past 100 years, with its startling industrial changes, has tended more and more to make life insecure. Young people have come to wonder what will their lot when they come to old age. The man with a job has wondered how long that job will last. This Social Security measure gives at least some protection to 50 million of our citizens who will reap direct benefits through unemployment compensation, through old age pensions, and through increased services for the protection of children and the prevention of ill health." He went on to say, quote, "The law will flatten out the peaks and valleys of deflation and inflation. It is, in short, a law that will care of human needs and at the same time provide the United States an economic structure of vastly greater soundness." Over the past few decades, politicians have increasingly sounded the alarm that Social Security will not remain viable as the large baby boomer generation retires and draws benefits. Yet despite those who seek to attack Social Security, it remains a bedrock of the social safety net for millions of Americans. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com, like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at laborhistoryin2.
Rolling rock around the country, yeah.
Welcome back to part two of the Friday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. Again, a reminder, we Zoom on Thursday morning. Joining us right now is John Nichols of The Nation magazine. I do love this quote. Author Gore Vidal says, "Of all the great slayers now about in the great American desert, John Nichols' sword is the sharpest." Wow, I got to borrow that sword sometime, John Nichols. John Nichols is a pioneering political blogger. He writes for politics for The Nation magazine as their national affairs correspondent. His pieces have been circulated everywhere. You see him on TV. He's a prolific writer of books. I have known him since 1991. It has always been an honor and a pleasure to not only say I am familiar with his work, but he is a friend. And when we were looking at this incredible week, John, I had to reach out to you. Everyone knew it was going to be Kamala. There was no surprise there. I talked to Bill Curry yesterday, and you'll love it. So Bill and I were talking, and I said, so how are you about the Kamala appointment? Because he's a very outspoken progressive, both pundit and writer and former politician. He said, here's the good news, Arnie. So I expected it. And so when I found out the announcement, he said, I was like, okay, this is fine. He said, and then the next morning, I was actually 10% happier than I was the night before. He said, so I am growing accustomed to this and it's not taking me down. It's actually bringing me up. And that's a good sign when Bill Curry can say, okay. And then the next morning going, okay. Sort of, I feel a little bit the same way. You know, it was of no surprise, but the more I thought about her, she really is the composite of the American dream. I mean, if you care about immigration policy, she is your star. If you care about diversity, she is your star. If you want to bring women into sort of higher levels of politics, she is your star. When you think about the fact that she grew up in a very sort of white, privileged environment in California and then decided to go to Howard University, you know, one of the famous black schools in America, in part to figure out who she was and to learn about that because that wasn't her experience growing up. You know, you can't run away from being black, but you may not have the experience of understanding what it really means and the challenges, and she went to Howard. So as you look at that, I'm sort of making my peace with her. And at the same time, I'm sort of curious how John Nichols, the great writer at The Nation magazine, how you thread the needle on both Joe Biden, his now choice of Kamala Harris, and what do you think that means, not only for this election going forward, but what it means for the future of the Democratic Party?
Well, I appreciate the question. And I now know that I'm going to have to get a Bill Curry weather gauge and put it out in front of my place and see how's he
feeling?
Doing today. It's funny. I think the best way to come at this is to talk about a piece I wrote yesterday. And we don't always talk about things that I've written, but this is one of those situations where reporters and writers are very lucky. When something happens, they get to dig into it, you know, not just read the articles that come out, but actually try and figure out something more, something to right. add to the discourse. And so I spent a lot of yesterday, after writing an initial piece on what I think is Kamala Harris's great strength, which is her debating skills, her prosecutorial skills.
With Pence.
Obviously, as a progressive, I have some challenges and concerns about some of her record as a prosecutor, but the fact is, she does have skills in that area. And if we simply look at that, my initial piece I wrote was about how, you know, just imagining the debate between her and Mike Pence, which yeah, I think is, you know, I've got October 7th on my calendar, if you get my drift.
I've got popcorn ready.
Yeah, exactly. And I think it will be important because that adds momentum. But yesterday, I really dug into her background a lot. And there was an interesting reason. As you know, I live in Madison, Wisconsin. And I was able to report and do a big piece on the fact that so did Kamala Harris. She lived for a year, almost a year in Madison. It's a fascinating story of young academics, her parents. Her yeah. parents are remarkable, were her father remarkable, mother was. They both immigrated to the United States around the same time, around 1960, roughly the year John Kennedy became president. They both came to Berkeley in California. Her mother from India, her father from Jamaica. They were both stunningly skilled, you know, best and the brightest, and right. very appropriate to that era. Her mother came to study nutrition and do all sorts of cancer research, ultimately, and things of that nature. Her father to study economics. They both got PhDs. They met not around on campus, but through their social activism. They were part of an activist group that was very oriented towards civil rights and social justice. Right. Her mother met Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. At a event in 1967. Her father was an outspoken campaigner for economic and social and racial justice. They literally took her to so many demonstrations that she says some of her first memories were looking at all the legs of all the people marching. She was in a stroller. And then, of course, like, as I said, they both got their PhDs. And they had to do what young academics do. They have to go, you know, on the market, so to speak.
Right. Where the jobs are, where the jobs are.
Wherever there's the place where they can teach or where they can do their research. They initially went to Champaign-Urbana, Illinois, for roughly a year. And that's where Kamala Harris's little sister was born. Our sister, Maya, was born. Then they went to Madison, where her father, Donald Harris, got an appointment as an associate professor of economics in 1968. Imagine coming to Madison, Wisconsin, one of the great activist towns in 1968. And her mother became a breast cancer researcher at the university. She was a little girl. I mean, she was like four at this point in her life. Her sister was even younger, but they spent roughly a time in Madison. And then the parents, Kamala and her sister Maya and her mother went back to Oakland. Her father stayed here. Eventually went to Stanford and became a distinguished professor of economics. I tell this whole story to tell you that, yes, her upbringing was different. It wasn't the same as everyone's, you know, but it is one that some people will understand well. And it took her to different parts of America. And then it took her to Montreal in Canada, where she graduated from the same high school as Leonard Cohen, where she was part of an incredibly rich, multiracial, multiethnic, multicultural, multilinguistic community, then obviously the more the story that we know going on from there. But I have to tell you, a day spent really digging into the story of her childhood, her youth, is which we do learn a lot about someone from, was incredibly instructive. And I'll just give you one little note. And again, there's all the issues and all the politics of it. But she says that one of her first memories was drifting off to sleep at night in her home, in their home in Madison, listening as her father put jazz records on the phonograph and would play, you know, like maybe, yeah. I don't know the artist, but imagine a Miles Davis or something. And her mother sometimes at night would sing gospel. This is a person who will compete for the vice presidency of the United States, has competed for the presidency, and potentially be the next vice president of the United States. I can't help but feel a little of what Bill Curry and what you're talking about.
Yeah, I am, you're making me smile. Yeah, and so, you know, Bill said the other day, he said, you know, I'm not always infatuated with biography.
Yeah, and I wanted good biography though.
Right. And I said, well, you know, I'm going to slap you around a lot because biography, I think, does play a significant role. I think it plays a significant role more than DNA. It's the experience in which you live. And so what you've just described to me makes me very happy in a lot of ways. It really sort of says how she was challenged. It sort of says what she was exposed to. It gives me a sense of what she saw. Because what you see is what you can imagine. What you see is maybe what you want to fix. What you see is maybe sort of forms your dreams. And so what you're describing to me is someone who saw a lot. I mean, I look at my biography. My parents were much more conservative. My father read me the Wall Street Journal and the Christian Science Monitor every night. I mean, that was my... They did, but it wasn't the green fairy tale book. It wasn't the red fairy tale book. I remember, and I was just telling someone that at the end of my dad's life, this is just so funny as you're talking about this, because I admired my father very much. Although we were very, very different politically, I was the liberal daughter and he was like sort of rolled his eyes. But he always told me to question authority. That was the one thing he taught me. Mm-hmm. And I remember at one point in time, I said, "You realize, Dad, it means questioning you." And he kind of smiled and said, "I know that." But then at the end of his life, he started watching too much Fox.
Oh.
And I was talking to my friend, and it's almost like it became a drug, all right?
Oh,
it's
yeah.
almost like it's an addiction. And yeah. at one point, I looked at my dad, who I adored everyone. Mm-hmm. And I said, "Papa, I love you, but I don't like you anymore."
Oh.
And it was the hardest thing for me to say, but because I saw the transformation in not a good way, mm-hmm. that the man who taught me my values and taught me to question everything was suddenly in a place where he was questioning nothing. And the one gift he gave me was to question. And what you're telling me about Kamala is also important. So as we look at this team and we look at Joe Biden, the other thing I said to Mel Goodman before was that what I really loved was what Joe said that he brought to Barack Obama, that he wanted Kamala to bring to him, was that he wanted his partner in this to challenge him, to question him. And I think that that is clearly obvious from her upbringing and from who she is, both as an attorney general, as well as, I mean, it's just something, questioning is what she does.
I think that's a very important thing to focus on. Look, I have been, and I don't want to sound cynical about this, but I have always been in the camp that, you know, I run screaming from the room when a presidential candidate says, I wanted to choose a vice president I could work with, right? No, I want you to choose a vice president who is going to challenge you and, you know, who brings a different energy. You want this combination of people. And also, frankly, I'm not that interested in them working together, you know, once they're in office. I'm interested in them in getting into office. And I think too frequently, especially on the Democratic side, there's a tendency to pick a vice presidential candidate thinking about governing without thinking about winning. And I think that was the challenge with Tim Kaine. Hillary Clinton believed that she could govern with him. There's no question of that. But the problem was that Tim Kaine didn't bring a lot of, to my mind, effective campaigning to and skills to that ticket. He was a good campaigner for Virginia, but not in the rest of the country. In the case of Kamala Harris, she proved herself in a presidential campaign. She did not win that campaign. There were certainly challenges. I wrote about the challenges that she faced as a candidate. And yet, where did she show her strength? In debating and in prosecuting her opposition, i.e., you know, going after them and doing so with no holds barred in a very intense, very effective way. And who knows that better than anybody else? Joe Biden.
Exactly. Because
Joe Biden took a hard hit from her in an early debate. I will go so far as to say that I think that the challenge to Joe Biden in that June 2019 debate was a huge part of his decline as a candidate. And remember, through most of the fall and into the winter of 2019 into 2020, people didn't think he was going to be the nominee, that he was going to make it. That is a very effective politics, whether you like her or not, on a, you know, some issue. And I give Biden credit, right? You know, he's a man of politics. He spent an immense amount of time, 50 years in it. And I think he looked at his prospective vice presidential candidates and said, I'm going to pick the person who gave me a hard time because would like her to give Mike Pence a hard
time. Very good. But no, but you're absolutely right. So as I'm looking at this, I want you to answer this question though. For whatever reason, Kamala never seemed to resonate with African-American women. So we know that Elizabeth Warren seemed to make the connection. She had the policies and the prescriptions that they could relate to. I mean, now they're very excited. Did she drop out so soon that we don't know whether she's able to sort of seal the deal? Was there an expectation? We can't expect this of I just don't know. But I always remember that it just seemed interesting that there wasn't this natural affinity and natural support, and that in fact, it was more Elizabeth Warren that was able to sort of generate that enthusiasm, and it wasn't Kamala.
Well, and remember, it wasn't really Warren either, because at the end of the day, the particularly African-American women in South Carolina delivered for Joe Biden. And so when the time came for the critical voting, it was Biden who, with some very important endorsements and frankly, with a lot of work, he got the lion's share of support. But you're right, Warren made connections. And so I will emphasize that Harris did, too, in some places and with some folks. But one of the things that people lose sight of is we will sit on these shows all the time and we will talk about money and politics, blah, blah, blah. We talk about how terribly damaging it is, how much politics deteriorates because of money. And then we're like, oh, and then this person lost. Well, no, if you want to figure out what happened with Kamala Harris, she pretty much ran out of money at a critical stage. She did exactly. not have the resources to maintain a truly national campaign. Remember, she was sort of dropping back to focus on Iowa, which is one mm-hmm. of the things they do when they're started running short of money. She was, you know, trying to narrow her staff in and focus on certain places. And it was just, she was running out of money. Maybe you can say all the things you want to about why that happens or how that happens, but that was the case. Okay. I cannot begin to emphasize to you the number of times I said in February, as Biden was fading, seemed to be fading, mm-hmm. that I felt that Kamala Harris and Cory Booker dropped out too soon.
I agree.
I thought they both should have, one or the other at least, but perhaps both of them, that they should have, even with no money, kind of, you know, just as long as they can get a plane ticket, kind of keep at it. Because my sense is that that race reshuffled radically in February into early March.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And so I think that those who try to portray Kamala Harris as a unsuccessful candidate or somebody who didn't get it together, it's true. She did not, you know, win. She did not get to the primaries. But I think that loses a lot of the nuance and it loses a lot of the subtlety of what actually happened. And I will emphasize to you one other thing. You want to know who was a really, really, really unsuccessful candidate for a Democratic nomination?
Who?
Joe Biden in 2008.
That's right.
What happened with him.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. That's
one
right.
One of his
That's
opponents right. watched him in the debates where he was quite good in 2008 and thought, you know what? That guy didn't put all the pieces together to become the nominee, but I would like him to be my vice presidential running mate.
So I just want to let you know that I was listening to a show and they were talking about the choice of Joe Biden as Obama's VP. And they talked about they had three speeches ready for Barack Obama. And I was a little depressed. I should never have listened to that show because here were the three speeches they had written. They had one written in case he chose Joe Biden. They had one written in case he chose Kane, okay? Tim Kaine. Mm-hmm. And the third one was Evan Bayh.
Oh.
I know. No, exactly. Your reaction. Oh, my God.
Calculus.
I was like, I didn't want to hear this. I didn't want to hear this. And of all of them, I would have chosen Joe Biden.
Yeah, I was going to say, he went left.
He went left. Is that all right? Isn't that interesting? So I heard that. And that's an interesting window in on Barack Obama. And I also want to remind everyone, Barack Obama has said over and over again, this is not 2008. Things no. need to change. We yes. need to do different things. We need to be more aggressive. So in a lot of ways, he's also sort of preparing the base that we are prepared to sort of move much farther than we were able to do in 2000, or that I was willing to do in 2008, but what must happen in 2020.
Well, I would tell you, I was willing to move pretty far to the left in 2008.
Oh, yeah, so was I.
I've been pretty ready along for quite a long time. And here's what I will tell you is the times always define a presidency. As much, sometimes more, than the person. It's one of the worst mistakes that those of us who write about politics and those of us who even write books now and again, one of the worst mistakes we make is that we focus so much on the individuals that we don't focus on the reality of what's going on around them.
The moment, exactly.
Richard Nixon was a surprisingly good president on environmental issues as a guy who showed no evidence of caring about the environment because you had Earth Day and the Times, you know, made it real. The next president of the United States is going to deal with, if it is Biden and if Kamala Harris is serving with him, they're going to deal with racial justice issues because the Times are demanding it with a volume and an energy that's going to make that happen. I don't know how in every way, but I know it will. I think the Times are going to move us to health care no matter what Joe Biden says and mass unemployment, and you don't end up there. That's reality.
And so it was really interesting. I had an economist on the other day where we were talking about the $600 per week that now doesn't exist because people are saying, oh, people are earning more than they're earning with their salary. And he reminded us, we were having this long conversation, a lot of people get their health care through their work. So when they lose their job, they don't just lose their wage, they lose their benefit package. Uh-huh. And that benefit package includes health care. And if you want to actually throw in the cost of COBRA, on top of what they were earning, he said, guess what? The $600 barely covered what it was they lost in wages, given what they get in an unemployment check, plus what they have to contribute in the way of COBRA, plus all the other expenses now, because now their home, now their daycare, now their education, now they're feeding children who used to get fed in school because they were so low income. Now they have to feed them at home. I mean, the $600 pales in comparison to what they actually have to pay.
And Arnie, it's also the reality of how hard it is to find a job at this point.
Yes.
My sister lost her job at the start of the pandemic. She's been very lucky. She's found another good job. It's rare. And I know through that window of watching her look and how very few jobs there are, and certainly very few jobs that pay a living wage. And so we're in a circumstance where whenever I hear a politician start, you know, going, oh, the $600, they won't work because of that. you know, there are two answers to that. Number one is everything you just said about the benefit package, right?
Yeah.
And also, if $600 on top of baseline unemployment is better than what you're getting paid at an American job,
there's something wrong with work. What I keep thinking at the convention, I've been saying this over, I want someone to do the math story. I want the whole thing is all about math. And for example, with the unemployment benefits, you see a range where the top in places like Mississippi is like $230. The top in Massachusetts, it's $850. But that's the top. They mean you could get an unemployment check of $100 a week. What do you buy with $100 a week? So people don't even know the range of unemployment compensation depending on the state in which you live. And the range is significant.
And it's an interesting thing that you say the math question, because I will tell you that doing the math right is a big deal.
Yes.
And describing it in the right way. You will recall that in 2012, of all things, at a time when Democrats thought that Barack Obama might have a tough reelect, it turned out to actually be a pretty solid big win. And I think it was largely because Obama mastered the moment, especially in the later stages of that campaign, as did Biden. But at the Democratic convention that summer, if you'll remember, it was Bill Clinton who gave the math speech.
Yes, he did.
People were blown away.
We need a math speech. We need a math speech. I'm telling you.
I'm not the biggest Clinton advocate or defender, but I'll tell you, when he just did that math, when he put it on the table, it was profoundly effective. And you're right. This is going to be a different campaign this time or a different convention this time, because they're not talking to a big convention hall that's going to erupt in applause. They're going to be talking like we are.
Yeah.
It's going to be a Zoom meeting. So that's different. It's harder. And one of the things that I'm going to emphasize is I think as you watch the speeches at this convention this time around, you're going to see people rise, people you didn't expect be highly effective, people you did expect to do well maybe not be so effective, because they're going to adjust how they communicate and, you know, how they look into that camera and do their talk. So I'm actually, weirdly enough, even though I'm sad that it's not in my city of Milwaukee,
I know.
I'm weirdly enough sort of excited or interested to watch on who figures out this new medium.
Well, it's interesting. I had a friend who, whenever she got in front of a camera, a TV camera, she almost made love to that camera. I mean, the person I knew and the person who presented herself, she was phenomenal. She knew how to hold herself. She knew how to sort of, when to inflect, when to not. It was a performance that was remarkable. People don't understand. Different mediums sort of celebrate different aspects of who you are. Bill Clinton is incredibly effective. I saw him and I spoke with him in front of 14,000 people. Holy moly. I mean, it was kind of like he was conducting an orchestra. It was just amazing to watch how he engaged. And then you get to watch some people who are just so great in that smaller, more intimate setting. And I'm hoping that as the party put together this convention, they understood the new medium as much as the person they were choosing. Because sometimes you might have a name that's impressive, but if they don't deliver an impressive sort of conversation, it not only hurts them, it hurts you. And whatever they do, I hope they understand this is an important opportunity. I think more people are going to tune in than have ever tuned into a convention before, in part because we're so desperate. Yeah,
we're going to figure that out. I think people will be listening. They'll certainly tune into the Biden and Harris speeches. But I will say keep an eye on a couple people who will be speaking. I know it's not a surprise that Elizabeth Warren, I think, will do this well when she speaks. And I also say keep an eye on Tammy Baldwin. She can have a very effective way in a one-on-one conversation. She'll be speaking, I think, on Thursday night.
Okay.
And the other person who I think is going to, I'm just going to tell you, I bet she's going to master it again, it will be Michelle Obama.
Oh, wow. Yeah. I mean, my husband who died, I mean, the sun rose and set on Michelle Obama. I was very jealous of her.
Well.
But John Nichols, as Gore Vidal said, of all the giant slayers now afoot in the great American desert, John Nichols' sword is the sharpest. And we are so glad that you shared your sword with us, Mr. Nichols from The Nation magazine. We will talk soon. It'll be an interesting week. We'll talk after the convention.
I look forward to it. I'm honored to be on with you.
All right, ciao. This is the Friday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Stephanie Collins and Dave Scott. We'll schmooze next week. Thank you for listening.